Thank you, Dan, for that kind introduction. Thank you all for the introduction as well, for the welcome. Thank you all for coming out on what can best be described, I think, as an incredibly blustery New England winter evening in the winter that will never end here. I appreciate you all coming out. Just a little bit by way of background, I figured I want to get to as much Q&A as possible, so I'm going to try and avoid going much longer than a half an hour, maybe a little longer, and then we can get into some give and take back and forth. Like Dan said, I'm going to be focusing on talking about clean energy policy in the Commonwealth, but as I see a few of the unfortunate souls who signed up for my politics and policy class last semester on the other side of the building here. A lot of our focus in that class was how, while there's always a policy answer to a problem you want to tackle, you always have to consider the political framework of that as well. So it's not enough to just have the best idea in the world if you can't build the political support. So really, and I apologize to my students from last semester, a lot of this will sound similar. I want to focus on the politics and the policy of climate change and how that affects policy and how that affects where we're going here in Massachusetts. A little bit of background and on why these issues are important to me. Like Dan referenced, I grew up around here. I'm from Pittsfield. I grew up in a family that was around politics. Election season, and not just election season, was a time that we talked about the candidates and the issues that were up for debate. My father ran for district attorney when I was 9 years old in 1990. I was the only one considered by my mother old enough to go out on the campaign trail with my dad. So I fell in love with politics because I thought it meant holding signs and eating donuts. But even beyond that, I loved the experience because I got to see people come up to my dad and talk to him about their concerns in their community, their hopes and their dreams for their community. And I didn't really think that that would ultimately lead to a career choice. But lo and behold, after I went to Providence College, I ended up with a couple of incredible opportunities. But I want to go back to that time at Providence College because that's the first big moment for me on environmental policy, on climate change, and on clean energy. And I will tell you, it was a complete fluke in the sense that not unlike many of you, when I was trying to decide what classes I was going to take, I was playing around with my schedule a little bit. And it just so happened that Politics of the Environmental Movement with Professor Tony Affini was a class that fit right into the slot that I wanted, not too early, not too late on a Friday, worked out just fine. And it's the one of the happier mistakes I've ever made. It was the class that really woke me up to the challenges that we faced moving forward if we wanted to make sure that our communities were sustainable, if we were moving forward in a way that was going to leave our communities, our Commonwealth, and this planet better off for generations to come. So that was really my first aha moment. After I was at Providence College, I thought I was going to go to law school. A lot of the law schools I applied to didn't think I was going to go to law school. And after a summer of sitting on a lawnmower at Tanglewood trying to figure out what I was going to do with myself, I ended up down in Washington, D.C., doing what everyone with a political science degree in Washington, D.C. does, which is wait tables and work at a bar, and interning up on Capitol Hill. I was lucky enough to get an opportunity after that to work in Congressman Delahunt from the Cape and Islands office and then work for Congressman Neal when he wasn't our congressman at that point, and finally for a couple of years for Congressman Olver. So that was a great experience for me. After that, I came back to Massachusetts to go to grad school. I had focused in my time in Washington on that intersection between environmental policy and community development and economic development, how we could make sure that we were creating jobs and opportunities in our communities, but at the same point, we weren't doing it in a way that was sacrificing the future Again, I grew up around here. In particular, I'm from Pittsfield. And I remembered friends' parents finding out about the fact that they had PCBs in their backyard. Friends' parents who had worked at GE at one point who found out that different sections of the company had been shut down or moved on. So I didn't want, if I ever had the opportunity to play a role in policymaking, to simply be creating jobs that could be creating problems instead of opportunities for future generations to come. So I came back here. I was working at Tufts, and I got a surprise call on St. Patrick's Day of 2006 that the state Senate seat that I now have the honor of sitting in had opened up. So I figured I would run for that seat because if all else failed, when somebody asked me, how was your summer, I could say, well, I ran for the state Senate and lost. What did you do? Turns out I didn't have to answer that question because I was lucky enough to win. But not too long after I was given the honor of serving in this capacity, I got a call from three paper mills in the southern Berkshires. Those paper mills had picked up the phone, had called us and said, listen, we've been talking with the electric company. We're just finding out about a rate increase that's going into effect. We're not sure how to tell you this, but we're going to have to close down. That was going to lead to 750, roughly, jobs that had been in the Berkshires for decades, in some cases close to century, north of a century, vanishing right away. Jobs that people used to be able to go to high school and then go right to work in one of the mills. And I said to myself at that point that I was going to do everything and anything that I could to try and make sure that we had a more forward-looking energy policy, that we weren't simply going to go through sort of these stops and starts and put jobs that had paid a middle-class wage at risk. So that was those were my two big sort of aha moments, right? Politics of the environmental movement in Providence College, and then getting that phone call from the mill operators. The third one really was sort of a more gradual one over time. Growing up around here, I saw these hills on either side, and all I thought to myself was, how can I get out of them? How can I get out on the other side? But really, as I came back, I started to appreciate the beauty of this community, started to realize how lucky I was to grow up here, and committed myself to trying to do everything and anything I could to make sure that future generations have the same natural beauty, the same incredible environment to be able to enjoy and pass on for years and years to come. So that's why these issues matter to me, and I'm sure they matter to you all, maybe for similar reasons, maybe for completely different reasons, right? So I have been incredibly lucky working in the state Senate to be able to work at a time where we have taken some significant steps to be a leader among the states when it comes to combating climate change through an aggressive clean energy, energy efficiency, and conservation set of policies. It's sort of been two phases, though, right? We're starting to enter another phase right now. That first phase, one that we went through, where Governor Patrick and his administration prioritized trying to do all that we could to make that transition or to expedite that transition from an economy built around fossil fuels to one that is built around and driven by clean energy, efficiency, and conservation. And that was a time really where the politics, right, and the policy aligned. You have to remember that in 2006, when Governor Patrick was elected, it was kind of like being in Massachusetts when Mitt Romney was elected and was starting to work on health care reform, right? If you think back to that sort of as a parallel, Romney working with Senator Kennedy and state leaders were working on health care reform. Many states were working on that issue. The hope was that it was going to bubble up and become a national solution. In 2006, we're in a very similar place when it came to clean energy and climate policy at the state level. You heard more and more about different states, different regions, trying to do what they could at that level, all being seen in one form or another as potential models for hopefully where a national climate plan would come into place, or there would be some type of rational national energy policy. So what were the outcomes of that, right, when the politics and the policy were aligned, where you had a governor and an administration that was committed to that course of action, and where you had a legislature that agreed with that course of action as well, right? That was maybe the most active legislative session that we've ever seen around energy policy. We passed the framework for all of our clean energy policy, the Green Communities Act. We passed the Global Warming Solutions Act that set up some of the most aggressive and stringent greenhouse gas reduction goals of any state in the nation. We passed the Green Jobs Act that created the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center so that we as a state could try and do everything we could to capture all of the economic benefits of doing the right thing by the environment. We made significant investments in land acquisition and preservation through the environmental bond bill. Increases in nearly every single account after decades and decades of decreasing all of those investments. We passed an ocean zoning bill, which might not seem that important as far away from the ocean as you can get here in western Massachusetts, but what was a significant part of a statewide strategy for trying to be able to take advantage of all the opportunities that were out there, right? Those are all of the pieces of legislation that we put into place. They enabled some of the policies that have allowed Massachusetts to be a leader over the past eight-plus years, and certainly a leader in a place that other regions look to today. They enabled long-term contracting that's helped finance clean energy projects, in particular land-based wind projects. They, along with companion pieces of legislation, have significantly increased over time the renewable portfolio standard, and we ought to do that again. They've increased the amount of energy and the types of energy that we allow to be net metered, one of the strongest incentives in particular for solar energy here in the Commonwealth. They've made energy efficiency our first fuel, so it is the resource that is procured before competitive suppliers have to go out and procure more electrons, more electricity in the marketplace. These and any number of other steps, right? But I could stand up here and list each and every one of those bills. What does it actually mean concretely? What does the progress actually look like? When Governor Patrick was signed or was sworn into office January of 2007, we had 2 megawatts of solar energy in Massachusetts. 2 megawatts of solar energy. Today, we have 752 megawatts of solar energy in Massachusetts. I am not a math major, but I'm pretty sure that is a 326 times increase in the amount of solar energy that we have in place. We had, at that point, between 5 and 6,000 jobs in clean energy, energy efficiency, and conservation. Today, we have north of 87,000 jobs in clean energy, clean tech, and conservation. We have north of almost 6,000 clean energy firms that are here in Massachusetts. And those jobs have increased, even through the recession that we faced, have increased on average north of 10% a year ever since the Green Communities Act was put into place. But it's not just on energy. Massachusetts has been first in the nation, as ranked by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, first in the nation in energy efficiency policy 3 years in a row and running. We invest more per capita, more per person, than any other state in the nation. The only state that invests more than us in energy efficiency is California, which is the seventh largest economy in the entire world. They ought to do that to at least try and keep up with us, right? At this point, we have reduced our greenhouse gas emissions in Massachusetts 15% below our 1990 levels. We're approaching 20%, And we have, with a few tweaks, I think, the ability to pretty quickly get to 25% below those goals. So that is the progress that we have seen here while the politics and the policy have been aligned. While you have leadership that agrees with the general direction that we're going, and where the question that we ask when we debate climate policy in Massachusetts is not if we ought to be doing anything, but how we ought to be achieving those broadly shared goals. And the reason we've been able to do that is not just because the political leadership has been aligned, but because there has been a consistent coalition that has come together, right? Come together sort of like one big family at the holidays, right? You aren't going to agree with everything your crazy uncle or your crazy aunt says. You might not agree with everything your brother or your sister says. Well, the utilities might disagree with the environmental organizations from time to time here in Massachusetts, but our utilities don't deny the existence of climate change. They can be tough to work with, but on the whole, they are committed to the goals. The business community may have some differences of opinions about how we get there from time to time, nor can there just be one opinion of the business community, but on the whole, has been largely committed to the goals that we have outlined. And in no small part because of those increasing numbers in employment in the clean energy and the clean tech sector. So we've had a consistent political leadership. We've also had a consistent coalition that is held together over time with the broadly shared goals of trying to do all we can to invest in clean energy, in energy efficiency, and in conservation. But now we're in a period of transition. I feel like if you taxed elected officials in Massachusetts right now for every time we said the word transition, we could probably, well, we'd far better fund MCLA. We'd certainly take care of the state deficit with our eyes closed. But there are any number of transitions ongoing right now. And it is less clear about whether or not the politics and the policy of energy issues generally and of climate change more specifically are as clearly aligned as they had been for the last 8 years. Now, I'm not saying they are or they aren't right now. It's just unclear about whether or not they are. And there's a couple of specific reasons for that, right? First of all, just simply put, we have a new governor, which means we have a new Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs, new commissioners at the Department of Public Utilities, Department of Energy Resources, Department of Environmental Protection. We have changeover in all of these agencies that has impacted already regulations in the sense that with the end of one administration and the beginning of the next, there is generally a pause while the incoming administration will review all of the policy decisions that will be made in the coming months and years ahead. But you also have external forces at this point that are at least challenging that coalition that has been set up. If any of you have opened an electricity bill in the last few months, you know what one of those forces is, which is the rising cost of electricity here in Massachusetts and more broadly in New England, right? There is no simple explanation for the rise in that cost. Some of the reasons behind it are good, some not. Right, in the sense that we have seen some of the dirtiest power-generating plants in New England, and in particular in Massachusetts, and some of the least safe power-generating plants in New England and in Massachusetts come offline. That has challenged not only Massachusetts, but New England as a whole to figure out how we are going to make up for that capacity. I will tell you that my bias is to make sure that we do everything we can to not simply rebuild the road or the bridge the way that it was built the last time, right? It makes no sense if our goal is the goal that we have had for the last 8 years, to expedite the transition to an economy built around clean energy, built around efficiency and conservation. It makes no sense to simply say, let's build right back to where we were and keep going down that road. But that is a debate that we are going to have here in Massachusetts, in the legislature, between and amongst members of the administration and with the legislature. I will tell you that I think there are a lot of areas that we agree with the Baker administration and where they agree with the legislature where we can make significant improvements and build on the success of the last few years. In particular, I think there is a great deal more that we can do in energy efficiency, in particular, to get directly to homeowners, get directly to small business owners, large business owners, to empower them to be able to reduce their bills through the smartest way possible, because it doesn't matter what you get charged a kilowatt hour if you aren't using that kilowatt hour of energy, right? There is any number of different steps that we can and should be taking on that front, both to make our energy grid work better and to make our own use of energy smarter, more effective, and more efficient. What's less clear, right, less in areas like energy efficiency, but more in clean energy policy, is just how aggressive the Baker administration is going to be in pursuing that agenda and doubling down on the work that we've done over the last 8 years. We're hopeful that they'll continue to move forward, but we're going to do all we can in the legislature to encourage them as well, right? Amongst the many committees that Dan mentioned, of which I am a member, as chair of the Energy Committee, I am a member of the Senate's Committee on Global Warming and Climate Change. We just put out a report that you can access if you go to the legislature's website, malegislature.gov. You look through the committees, it'll be right there, and that I think is called No Time to Waste. I think, pun intended. If not, we'll take credit for it. Specifically focus on the steps that the Baker administration could or should take to be able to keep us moving forward, right? Because I think the most important lesson to learn from the last 8 years where the politics and the policy were aligned is that while we have made a great deal of progress, it is not as if we have achieved a goal, right? I am hesitant sometimes to point out that Massachusetts is first among many states when it comes to our climate and clean energy policy because being better than bad isn't good enough, right? You know, that's sort of like saying right now that you're the best basketball player on the Boston Celtics. Like, you know, it's Larry Bird's not walking through that door. You know, Paul Pierce isn't walking through that door. We need to flat out be better and do better. And the good thing is the more that Massachusetts leads, the more that other states will follow. So if you look through that report, there are any number of recommendations about policies that we can and should implement both regulatorily and through the legislature to build on the success that we've had over the last 8 years. Whether that's moving forward on modernizing our electric grid, so it's actually a grid that communicates both ways from energy users to the utility companies so that we can get to storm outages quicker, but also be able to send price signals to customers so that they know when to use their appliances better so that they can get a better rate for when you're charging your electric appliances, whether it's something as complex as a plug-in hybrid or as simple as charging your cell phone, right? Grid modernization makes all the sense in the world. It requires investments. It requires public policy to nudge it along. So I'm actually excited, right, for where we are right now. The last 8 years, we all knew where it was going. There is a great deal of possibility and opportunity in the unknown of where we are right now. But given what Governor Baker has said about his desire to be driven by data when it comes to decision making, I think the data are clear on the success of the last 8 years. We don't control everything at the state level. As we try to make these policies, we have to deal with federal agencies that could come in and, to put it mildly, throw a monkey wrench in the middle of all of it. But I think we do know what we can control, and we do know that when we align the politics and the policy, when we have the leadership at all levels that is focused not on the if we should do anything, but on the how we should do it, that we can not only lead on protecting and preserving the environment, but we can do so in a way that creates economic opportunity in every corner of this commonwealth, and in a way that doesn't sacrifice future generations. So with that, I'd like to take some time now to do some Q&A.
My name is Josh. I'm from Lee. I was just wondering if you have any ideas of maybe some of the jobs that got lost with the paper mills closing could be kind of replaced with green jobs in the area?
Yeah, it's it is absolutely a goal. So one of the things that we've tried to do is create retraining programs specifically for people in industries that have seen significant upticks in unemployment, or where there have been especially that rapid type of job loss. We've worked in particular with Berkshire Community College with a program that I helped create called the Pathways Out of Poverty Program, specifically aimed at retraining displaced workers, helping workers who come from census tracts with a high poverty figure. I know some of our local employers have been great about working with folks that have come out of those programs, who have been trained and have the ability to step right into the workplace. The hope would be that as we create those opportunities, that's going to align with people who lost those jobs. I know in reality that isn't always the case, so we need to try and create as many opportunities as possible. Quite frankly, I think when you talk about the Southern Berkshires, one thing the Southern Berkshires doesn't have that the Northern Berkshires does that's a great part of the partnership on that, beyond MCLA, right, is McCann, right? McCann's a great partner, especially in helping people reskill and retool themselves and be able to get jobs that, quite frankly, aren't going to be shipped off to China or India anytime soon. They're jobs that need to be done right here. And we have challenges in the Berkshires entirely unrelated from energy policy around making sure that people have access to those training opportunities, just because the region is so spread out and transportation is so difficult. But if you have specific people who are looking for help or ideas, that's what my office is there for, too. So don't hesitate to reach out. I'll make sure to give you my card after. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Gianna. I'm from Pittsfield, and I work for Beacon. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, you said we all have power and to change things.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if, say, somebody here at MCLA wants to get involved, what could they do to get involved?
Yeah, any number of different things, right? One, depending on where your hometown is, try and see whether or not they've become a green community, and work with your local elected officials to see whether or not they have sought that designation. Many communities, Pittsfield included, have sought that designation already, but that's a great way to start a campaign in your community. If you have a connection to a public institution, ask who is the person, whether it's in maintenance, finance, or administration, who's specifically tasked with overseeing the sustainability efforts at that institution. And that shouldn't just be public or private, right? You should ask that of any, especially if it's a larger institution. But talk to them about what they're doing and see either what they need for support or how you can be an advocate for those efforts, right? Those are two things. Three, organize and find either an organization that you want to get involved with that is advocating on these issues, right? Or start one yourself. Start your own chapter. Engage with one of those groups, whether it's MassPERG, Environmental League of Voters, Mass League of Environmental Voters, Sierra Club, right? No matter what the issue, and think about the issue that made you passionate about the environment. Get involved with the organization that aligns with you there, and in particular for younger people, right? I get frustrated when I hear younger people talk as if they have no power over elected officials. Maybe because they aren't old enough to vote yet, or just because generally they are younger. There is nothing that scares elected officials more than young people organizing, especially young people organizing in their district. Get organized and reach out to your local elected officials and say, what are you doing to be a part of the solution, right? And that can be talking about specific projects locally, or it can be saying, are you supporting certain legislation at the state level?
Got a question?
Yeah, I'm Evan. I'm from Gosselwood, Mass.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is on the other side of the state from you, I guess, but I was wondering what you mean about Cape Wind and progress.
Yeah. Gosnold's officially the smallest community in Massachusetts, right, by population? Yeah, it's pretty close. It also has the highest energy costs in all of Massachusetts because you got to bring the oil out there, right? Yeah. Cape Wind, right? In the Green Communities Act, we created a requirement for the utilities in Massachusetts. Despite their ever-changing names, we essentially have two utilities in Massachusetts and part of a third utility, right? We have National Grid, which serves the area where we are right now. We have Eversource, which was Northeast Utilities, which was Wameco, which was merged with NSTAR. If you can follow along with all that, just Eversource. They got a name. I don't know why they got a new name. That's their choice, right? You have those two big utility companies. In the Green Communities Act, we required the utility companies to go out to bid for long-term contracts. One, why was that different than anything they would normally do? And two, why would we do that? In 1997, we deregulated our electricity market here in Massachusetts. And so electricity was sold on the market and not for terms longer than a year. So anything longer than a year had to be approved by the Department of Public Utilities. The reason why we would require a longer-term contract, and the thinking on that was these long-term contracts led to stranded costs. Think of Alex Rodriguez, right? Alex Rodriguez is currently a stranded cost for the New York Yankees. I'm sorry if you're a Yankees fan, but you probably wouldn't want to pay him that right now if you didn't have to, right? But he's got a contract. He's locked up. Our energy grid for too long was sort of locked up in a lot of long-term contracts. It didn't make a lot of sense. I really didn't expect to reference Alex Rodriguez today or in answering this question. But we realized that one of the challenges in getting renewables both to be cost competitive and to be therefore adopted was the financing of renewable energy projects. That's what the goal of any number of the different incentives and subsidies that have been put in place, by the way, all of which are significantly smaller than the incentives and subsidies that have been put in place for fossil fuels over time, right? But in putting that in place, the hope was drive down the cost of projects like Cape Wind and others. So ultimately, after some convincing, the utility companies had entered in to contracts, both Northeast Utilities, so Eversource, and National Grid had agreed to purchase roughly each about 35%, I think, of the project, which was going to allow the project to be financed and to move forward. Unfortunately, in the last 3 to 6 months, for any number of different reasons, Cape Wind hasn't hit some of the requirements that they had to in the contracts that they had with the utility companies. And in particular, Eversource, which was the tougher of the two to convince, has backed out of their commitment and seems to be on pretty strong legal ground in doing so. So how we finance Cape Wind and how we finance offshore wind generally is an open question right now. And one which I will tell you I don't know the answer to. It is something where, for comparison's sake, projects, offshore wind projects, are when they are spec'd out, look to cost about 21 to 22 cents a kilowatt hour. Land-based wind projects are coming in the 7 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour, right? So there's a significant difference. So you would... Absent being allowed to purchase land-based wind, you'd essentially have to have a requirement for just purchasing that offshore wind. And given where electric rates are and given where customer concerns are, it's difficult to see how you make that work. Quite frankly, absent something that's going to change the dynamic on those costs. I tend to think the federal government needs to step in, especially to deal with some of the costs, whether it's transmission lines or others, that would change some of the math there. So we're working with the delegation from the South Coast, the delegation from the Cape, in particular Senator Wolf, who's been a real leader on all this. He's the owner of Cape Air. They're one of the most sustainable airlines you could ever imagine. They've done a great deal around efficiency and conservation and solar. And I'm working with Senator Wolf. Senator Montigny represents New Bedford, the port that would like to be able to do a lot of that work to try and come up with a solution. So this is my long way of saying we don't know just yet. And unfortunately, no state has cracked that code yet. And it is maybe more than any other question we face at the state level. That's where we need help and a partner in the federal government that we haven't had the way we'd like to have it.
If the federal government is lagging, if the state government is lagging, why can't communities start projects for microgrids? So I know that that's entangled with a lot of questions about incentives and finances and legislation.
Yeah, I would say it's less about incentives and legislation, right, and more about legislation, right? So one of the things that the utility companies guard the most zealously is their franchise, right? And their franchise is, you know, essentially where they have their rights of way, where they are allowed to operate. And that is written directly in to the Mass General Laws as part of the 1997 Electric Restructuring Act. That has been a hurdle to a lot of things, not just to microgrids. So there have been any number of solar projects I know that have sought to cross the franchise of the utility company, to cross their right-of-way, even if it's just across a street to make an interconnection, only to be blocked and then not be able to go forward. That being said, there's a lot of interest around microgrids. It's something that we call for in the No Time to Waste report. It's something that should be part of the grid modernization docket that's before the Department of Public Utilities. And it's something that I think we're trying to figure out if we can't get the numbers, right? And by numbers, I mean 21 votes in the Senate or 81 votes in the House to amend the franchise legislation, then we need to come up with some other way to incentivize microgrids, right? In particular, there's a lot of interest from hospitals, right, who are very concerned around storm outages, that if they don't have the ability to stay up, to be powered, and to be able to essentially island off themselves from the rest of the electric grid, then they're going to be in horrible places, to put it mildly. There are a couple examples of microgrids in the greater Boston area that I think show promise. There may well be legislation that was filed, admittedly about 6,400 bills, 6,500 bills get filed each year. We'll get between 250 and 500 of those, depending, to the Telecom Utilities and Energy Committee. So if we make sure to hook up later, I can make sure to send you whatever's been filed too, and we can let you know when there's a hearing on it as well. It hasn't been as much conversation out here on the microgrid front, at least that I've heard. It's when I have heard it, it has been especially focused around hospitals and colleges, largely because they have that sort of campus feeling anyway. Yeah, it's an area I need to do some research on too. So thanks for reminding. Appreciate it. Sure.
A couple things quickly. When a new administration comes into, oh, my name's Tony, I'm from North Adams. A new administration is elected, and you say that there's a big changeover in all the department heads and stuff like that. How are those people chosen, and do you guys have any say in who gets picked? The other quick question is, you see a lot of solar, like big solar arrays going up in like landfills and stuff like that. I was just wondering why don't the towns themselves like put these up and operating rather than having private companies come in.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So a couple of different things on that. One, on the first question, those appointments are all appointments that are completely up to the governor. Unlike the federal model, And I think, honestly, for the better. But unlike the federal model, where many appointees require Senate confirmation to be able to operate in their position, the governor in Massachusetts has the ability to appoint his cabinet members. There are some appointments, for instance, the commissioner of elementary and secondary education has to be approved by a board. I believe there are a few others as well along those lines. But in the environmental secretariat, they all serve at the governor's pleasure at this point. And I think, you know, there have been some I've been a little bit skittish about, some I'm very hopeful on. So we'll have to wait and see how that shakes out. Remind me of all the details of your second part of your question again. I apologize. Yeah. All right. For the most part, the reason is because it's the model that we've got right now, right? That's what you've seen. You do have in Massachusetts, not as many out here, municipal utilities. Municipal utilities could own and operate a solar facility. Now, municipal utilities don't pay into the clean energy programs that I listed before. They are allowed to operate independent of those laws. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. I have tried to change that and have run up against the wall that is stiff opposition from my colleagues who represent the municipal utilities. You know, admittedly, there is a principle there in the sense of public power should be allowed to make their decisions their ways. Private power has to live with the regulation from a state government. I appreciate that, but I think, you know, we're past that when it comes to climate change and clean energy. So, you know, I'm of the mindset I'd like to be the biggest proponent possible for municipal utilities, and would be if they were committed to the same set of climate and clean energy policies that we have for everybody else in the state. So it's just because we don't have them out here, that's why you don't see that set up. Yeah, Dan?
I'm Dan from North Adams. So you've spoken a lot about what we call mitigation strategies for climate change, so reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. So one of the things we've heard about the last couple of weeks in the presentations is that we're kind of in reducing some climate warming no matter what we do. And so my question is related to our coastline, and to which we severely impacted for sea level rise. Is there a role for the state in adapting to what we anticipate with coastal changes?
Yeah, there absolutely is. There is you have the Coastal Zone Management Act, but also in his last few years in office, Governor Patrick set up a fund specifically designed to support pilot programs around resiliency, so adaptation strategies around climate change. I got to tell you, I'm always sort of torn when I talk about resiliency or adaptation because I don't want to think that we're going to throw in the towel and say, hey, we got to live with this, let's find a way to pay for it. I do think it's important to recognize and realize that some of the impacts of the storms that we're seeing now are the impacts of climate change that we're being forced to live with. But we need to take that not as a reason to sort of lay down the sword, but a reason to fight on. So we have that one resiliency fund. I expect, and I know from a first look through of the bills that are before the committee, we have any number that are focused more on the resiliency and adaptation set of issues. So I think that's probably going to be something where we spend a lot of time over the next few weeks and months.
So I'm B from Worcester. I'm working currently with the Berkshire Environmental Action Team to basically write to state legislators about preventing the Kinder Morgan pipeline from coming. One of the things that we're going to do is create basically a photojournalism kind of in style by Humans of New York from students in Massachusetts schools to send to these people. I was wondering if you had anything that you think would be particularly potent in that.
You know, I think your faces, your stories, right, your personal stories about why you got involved in the issue, why you're opposed to the pipeline, like I'm opposed to the pipeline, right? Sharing those stories has a real impact, right? This is, again, something we talked about with the node of 350 last night. A lot of people write to us, right? People fill out petitions, people send form letters, and that's important, right? It's important to weigh in. The most impactful and powerful thing is a personal story, right? We know the difference between someone signing up for something online and just hitting send, and someone who sat down at a computer and said, this matters to me, this is important to me, and this is why. This is why I've taken the time from my busy day to write to you and say, you need to do everything you can to stop this or to invest in that, right? That make it personal, right? The more personal it is and the more those truly personal stories pile up, and this goes for any issue, by the way. I mean, this is citizen advocacy 101. If you care about something, you know, don't sign up for an organization where you're just going to get spammed with email that you're going to say, yeah, fine, whatever, and send it. Like, that's pointless. Quite frankly, it's bad for the environment because the energy to do that has to come from somewhere, right? That's silly, right? Think about the issues that matter to you and take the 5, the 10, the 15 minutes to write a personal letter to the decision maker on those, right? Whether it's state legislators and reps on clean energy policy, whether it's members of Congress to weigh in with the FERC on the pipeline, whether it's your local city council mayors or select board members to be more aggressive in pursuing green community status and adopting the stretch code in supporting any number of clean energy projects in your community. The personal stories are what matter. Personal stories. One last thing. All right. Raise your hand if you own a home, live in an apartment here in the Berkshires. Right? Have any of you... Oh, keep those hands up. Hold on. How many of you have called the utility company to get your home energy assessment? All right. All of you, put your hands down. You need to call the... No. Keep them up still. All of you who have... Pick up the phone and call them tomorrow. It's free. You pay for it already. Get your assessment right. Everybody who's got your hands up who's done the assessment, have you done what they recommended you to do? All right, you're all good. Good for you. I can't, right? That's something right now, right? You pay into it with your utility bill. You pay for those assessments, right? And you can get one, I think, every year, if not every 2 years. I think it's every year, right? Pick up the phone, call them, sign up, get the assessment. See what's there for incentives, see what's there for support and grants, right? And take advantage of it. And if you think it's too burdensome a process, you think it doesn't work, well, then pick up the phone and call your state legislator and say, hey, I really like the process, but here's what's wrong with it. Work with the Energy Efficiency Advisory Council to make the thing work better, right? Demand more of us so that we can do better with it, because we've all got to do better with it, right? Like, I woke up 2 months ago and realized it had been 3 years since I did my last one. And my place is a little drafty. It's a little cold right now. So, you know, I got my assessment. I'm going through it. I'm figuring out what I could do. We all got to do better. So thank you all for having me. And if I can say one last thing, well, two last things, right? One, don't hesitate to reach out to your local elected officials. Me, Representative Caridi, the entire delegation, your city council members, your select board members, pick up the phone and call or write. There's nothing worse than bumping into someone and them saying, I was going to give you a call, but I didn't think it mattered. It matters. It always matters, right? Number one. Number two, on these issues, it can be so easy on climate change to think literally that the world is ending, that everything is horrible, that there's nothing that you can do. It's easy to curl up in a ball and say nothing, or if you do say something, to be incredibly negative about it, right? This is an awesome opportunity, right? I am excited about the opportunity and the possibility if we get this right. And think about this. Over the last 8 years, 2 megawatts, 752 megawatts, right? We've added nearly 5,000 jobs in clean energy, or 5,000 companies in clean energy and clean tech. We've added jobs at 10%+ a year. We've got 88,000 jobs. These are things to celebrate and be positive about, right? Too often, I think, and I consider myself an environmentalist, too often us environmentalists are, oh no, the world is ending, there's nothing we can do. we have a good story to tell, a positive story to tell. And if we do the right thing, our economy is stronger and our environment is protected and preserved. Be positive. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thanks.